The clock struck 10 while the trunks were carrying down, and the general had fixed to be out of Milsom Street by that hour. The middle seat of the chaise was not drawn out, though there were 3 people to go in it, and his daughter's maid had so crowded it with parcels that Miss Morland would not have room to sit. At last, however, the door was closed upon the 3 females, and they set off at a sober pace. Catherine admired the style in which they travelled in the fashionable chaise and four. Postilions, handsomely liveried, rising so regularly in their stirrups, and numerous outriders properly mounted. Her spirits revived as they drove from the door, for with Miss Tilney she felt no restraint. With the interest of a road entirely new to her, of an abbey before and Henry's curricle behind, she caught the last view of Bath without any regret, and met with every milestone before she expected it. The tediousness of a 2 hours' wait at Petit France, in which there was nothing to be done but eat without being hungry and loiter about without anything to see, next followed. Had their party been perfectly agreeable, the delay would have been nothing. But General Tilney, though so charming a man, seemed always a check upon his children's spirits. Scarcely anything was said but by himself, the observation of which, with his discontent at whatever the inn afforded and his angry impatience at the waiters, made Catherine grow every moment more in awe of him and appeared to lengthen the 2 hours into 4. At last, however, the order of release was given, and much was Catherine then surprised by the general's proposal of her taking his place in his son's curricle for the rest of the journey. The day was fine, and he was anxious for her seeing as much of the country as possible. The remembrance of Mr. Allen's opinion, respecting young men's open carriages, made her blush at the mention of such a plan, and her first thought was to decline it. But her second was of greater deference for General Tilney's judgment. He could not propose anything improper for her. And in the course of a few minutes, she found herself with Henry in the curricle, as happy a being as ever existed. Henry drove so well, so quietly, without making any disturbance, without parading to her or swearing at the horses, so different from the only gentleman coachman whom it was in her power to compare him with. And then his hat sat so well, and the innumerable capes of his greatcoat looked so becomingly important. To be driven by him, next to dancing with him, was certainly the greatest happiness in the world.
I must thank you on my sister's account for becoming her visitor. It is a sign of real friendship, and she is sincere in her gratitude. My sister is uncomfortably circumstanced. She has no female companion, and in the frequent absence of our father, is sometimes without any companion at all.
But how can that be? Are you not with her?
Northanger is not more than half my home. I have an establishment at my own house in Woodston, which is nearly 20 miles from my father's, and some of my time is necessarily spent there.
How sorry you must be for that.
I am always sorry to leave Eleanor.
Yes, but besides your affection for her, you must be so fond of the Abbey. After being used to such a home as the Abbey, an ordinary parsonage house must be very disagreeable.
You have formed a very favourable idea of the Abbey.
To be sure I have. Is not it a fine old place, just like what one reads about?
And are you prepared to encounter all the horrors that a building such as what one reads about may produce? Have you a stout heart? Nerves fit for sliding panels and tapestry?
Oh, yes. I do not think I should be easily frightened, because there would be so many people in the house, and besides, it has never been uninhabited and left deserted for years, and then the family come back to it unawares without giving any notice, as generally happens.
No, certainly, we shall not have to explore our way into a hall dimly lighted by the expiring embers of a wood fire, nor be obliged to spread our beds on the floor of a room without windows, doors, or furniture. But you must be aware that when a young lady is, by whatever means, introduced into a dwelling of this kind, she is always lodged apart from the rest of the family. While they snugly repair to their own end of the house, she is formally conducted by Dorothy, the ancient housekeeper, up a different staircase and along many gloomy passages into an apartment never used since some cousin or kin died in it about 20 years before. Can you stand such a ceremony as this? Will not your mind misgive you when you find yourself in this gloomy chamber, too lofty and extensive for you, with only the feeble rays of a single lamp to take in its size, its walls hung with tapestry exhibiting figures as large as life, and the bed of dark green stuff or purple velvet presenting even a funereal appearance? Will not your heart sink within you?
Oh, but this will not happen to me, I am sure.
How fearfully will you examine the furniture of your apartment, and what will you discern? Not tables, toilettes, wardrobes or drawers, but on one side, perhaps, the remains of a broken lute, and on the other a ponderous chest which no efforts can open. And over the fireplace, the portrait of some handsome warrior whose features will so incomprehensibly strike you that you will not be able to withdraw your eyes from it. Dorothy, meanwhile, no less struck by your appearance, gazes on you in great agitation and drops a few unintelligible hints. To raise your spirits, moreover, she gives you reason to suppose that the part of the abbey you inhabit is undoubtedly haunted, and informs you that you will not have a single domestic within call. With this parting cordial, she curtsies off. You listen to the sound of her receding footsteps as long as the last echo can reach you. When, with fainting spirits, you attempt to fasten your door, you discover with increased alarm that it has no lock.
Oh, Mr. Tilney, how frightful! This is just like a book. Oh, but it cannot really happen to me. I am sure your housekeeper is not really Dorothy. Well, what then?
Nothing further to alarm, perhaps, may occur the first night. After surmounting your unconquerable horror of the bed, you will retire to rest and get a few hours' unquiet slumber. But on the second, or at farthest the third night after your arrival, you will probably have a violent storm. Peals of thunder so loud as to seem to shake the edifice to its foundation will roll round the neighbouring mountains. During the frightful gusts of wind which accompany it, you will probably think you discern, for your lamp is not extinguished, one part of the hanging more violently agitated than the rest. Unable, of course, to repress your curiosity in so favourable a moment for indulging it, you will instantly arise and, throwing your dressing gown around you, proceed to examine this mystery. After a very short search, you will discover a division in the tapestry so artfully constructed as to defy the minutest inspection. And on opening it, a door will immediately appear. That door being only secured by massy bars and a padlock, you will, after a few efforts, succeed in opening and, with your lamp in your hand, will pass through it into a small vaulted room.
No, indeed. I should be too much frightened to do any such thing.
What? Not when Dorothy has given you to understand that there is a secret subterraneous communication between your apartment and the chapel of St. Anthony, scarcely 2 miles off? Could you shrink from so simple an adventure? No, no, you will proceed into this small vaulted room, and through this into several others, without perceiving anything very remarkable in either. In one, perhaps, there may be a dagger. In another, a few drops of blood. And in the third, the remains of some instrument of torture. But there being nothing in all this out of the common way, and your lamp being nearly exhausted, you'll return towards your own apartment. In repassing through the small vaulted room, however, your eyes will be attracted towards a large, old-fashioned cabinet of ebony and gold, which, though narrowly examining the furniture before, you had passed unnoticed. Impelled by an irresistible presentiment, you will eagerly advance to it, unlock its folding doors, and search into every drawer. But for some time, without discovering anything of importance, perhaps nothing, but a considerable hoard of diamonds. At last, however, by touching a secret spring, an inner compartment will open. A roll of paper appears. You seize it. It contains many sheets of manuscript. You hasten with the precious treasure into your own chamber, but scarcely have you been able to decipher, "O thou, whomsoever thou mayest be, into whose hands these memoirs of the wretched Matilda may fall," when your lamp suddenly expires in the socket and leaves you in total darkness.
Oh, no, no, do not say so. Oh, well, go on.
I'm sorry. I cannot be serious any longer. You must imagine Matilda's woes for yourself.
I did not think of really meeting with what you related. Miss Tilney, I am sure, would never put me into such a chamber as you have described. I am not at all afraid.
As they drew near the end of their journey, Catherine was impatient for a sight of the abbey, expecting with solemn awe to gain a glimpse of its massy walls of grey stone, rising amidst a grove of ancient oaks, with the last beams of the sun playing in beautiful splendour on its high Gothic windows. But so low did the building stand that she found herself passing through the great gates of the lodge into the very grounds of Northanger without having discerned even an antique chimney. To find herself with such ease in the very precincts of the abbey, and driven so rapidly along a smooth, level road of fine gravel without obstacle, alarm or solemnity of any kind, struck her as odd and inconsistent. She was not long at leisure, however, for such considerations. A sudden scud of rain driving full in her face made it impossible for her to observe anything further, and fixed all her thoughts on the welfare of her new straw bonnet.
Oh, I cannot see.
We are very nearly at the door.
Trot on, trot on.
Allow me to help you out. Oh dear, I'm afraid you would have been better off with Eleanor in the chaise.
No, 'tis no matter.
Welcome to Northanger, Miss Morland.
Thank you, General.
I'm so sorry you were caught in the rain, Miss Morland.
It was not much, Miss Tilney. Thank you.
Come, let us go through to the drawing room.
Catherine was surprised at having passed so far into the abbey without feeling one awful foreboding of future misery to herself, or one moment's suspicion of any past scenes of horror. The breeze had not seemed to waft the sighs of the murdered to her. It had wafted nothing worse than a thick, mizzling rain. And as they passed into the common drawing room, little matched the solemn Gothic splendour she had imagined. The furniture was in all the profusion and elegance of modern taste. The fireplace, where she had expected the ample width and ponderous carving of former times, was contracted to a Rumford, with ornaments over it of the prettiest English china. The windows were yet less what her fancy had portrayed. To be sure, the pointed arch was preserved. The form of them was Gothic. They might be even casements, but every pane was so large, so clear, so light. To an imagination which had hoped for the smallest divisions and the heavier stonework for painted glass, dirt and cobwebs, the difference was very distressing.
I think, Miss Morland, I have not given you a fair introduction to Northanger by showing you this room first of all. It is small and simply furnished, since everything is for daily use and only to comfort. I flatter myself, however, that there are some apartments in the abbey not unworthy of your notice. One in particular has a costly gilding, which I believe you shall... Goodness, it is within 15 minutes of 5.
Oh, Miss Morland, let me show you to your apartment. I'm afraid you must only make as little alteration as possible in your dress. Dinner time is at 5. My room is only 2 doors away from yours. Oh, I do hope you shall be comfortable.
I'm sure I shall.
Catherine was shown to her room, and a moment's glance was enough to satisfy her that the apartment was very unlike the one which Henry had endeavoured to alarm her by the description of. It was by no means unreasonably large and contained neither tapestry nor velvet. The walls were papered, the floor was carpeted, and the air of the room altogether far from uncheerful. Once alone, Catherine resolved to lose no time in particular examination of anything, as she greatly dreaded disobliging the general by any delay. Her habit, therefore, was thrown off with all possible haste, and she was preparing to unpin the linen package when her eyes suddenly fell on a large, high chest standing back in a deep recess on one side of the fireplace. The sight of it made her start, and forgetting everything else, she stood gazing on it in motionless wonder while these thoughts crossed her.
This is strange indeed. An immense, heavy chest. What can it hold? Why should it be placed here, pushed back too, as if it meant to be out of sight? I will look into it. Cost me what it may, I will look into it, and directly too, by daylight, if I stay my candle may go out.
She advanced and examined it closely. It was of cedar, curiously inlaid with some darker wood. The lock was silver, though tarnished from age. At each end were the imperfect remains of handles, also of silver, broken perhaps prematurely by some strange violence, and on the centre of the lid was a mysterious cipher in the same metal. Catherine bent over it intently. She could not believe the last letter to be a T, and yet, if the chest was not originally the Tilneys, by what strange events could it have fallen into the family? Her fearful curiosity was every moment growing greater, and seizing with trembling hands the hasp of the log, she resolved at all hazards to satisfy herself at least as to its contents. With difficulty, for something seemed to resist her efforts, she raised the lid a few inches. But at that moment a sudden knocking at the door of the room made her, starting, quit her hold, and the lid closed with alarming violence. This ill-timed intruder was Miss Tilney's maid, sent by her mistress to be of use to Miss Morland, and though Catherine immediately dismissed her, it recalled her to the sense of what she ought to be doing, and forced her, in spite of her anxious desire to penetrate this mystery, to proceed in her dressing without further delay. Having slipped one arm into her gown, however, her toilette seemed to be so nearly finished that the impatience of her curiosity might safely be indulged. One moment, surely, might be spared. With this spirit, she sprang forward, and her resolute effort drew back the lid and gave to her astonished eyes the view of a white cotton counterpane, properly folded, reposing at one end of the chest in undisputed possession.
Oh! Miss Morland, are you ready? Oh, that is a curious old chest, is not it? It's impossible to say how many generations it has been here. How it came to be first put in this room, I know not, but I have not had it moved because I thought it might sometimes be of use in holding hats and bonnets. The worst of it is that its weight makes it difficult to open. In that corner, however, it is at least out of the way. I fear we may be late if we do not hurry.
I shall be but half a minute. Well, might you help me with my ribbon? I should have asked your maid, but I did not notice it was loose.
Of course. Let's sit at the mirror a moment. There. Come, I'm afraid we must run if we are to be on time. Here we are, Father.
Dinner to be on table directly.
Sit a moment, Catherine. We can rest here before we go into the dining parlour.
Thank you.
Eleanor, you have been foolish in hurrying your friends so. There was not the least occasion for hurry in the world.
The evening passed without any further disturbance, and in the occasional absence of General Tilney, with much positive cheerfulness. The night was stormy. The wind had been rising at intervals the whole afternoon, and by the time the party broke up, it blew and rained violently. Catherine, as she crossed the hall, listened to the tempest with sensations of awe, and when she heard it rage round a corner of the ancient building and close with sudden fury a distant door, felt for the first time that she was really in an abbey. Yes, these were characteristic sounds. They brought to her recollection a countless variety of dreadful situations and horrid scenes which such buildings had witnessed and such storms ushered in. And most heartily did she rejoice in her happier circumstances. She had nothing to dread from midnight assassins or drunken gallants. In a house so furnished and so guarded, she could have nothing to explore or to suffer, and might go to her bedroom as securely as if it had been her own chamber at Fullerton. Thus, wisely fortifying her mind, she was enabled to enter her room with a tolerably stout heart, and her spirits were immediately assisted by the cheerful blaze of a wood fire. She looked round the room. The window curtains seemed in motion. It could be nothing but the violence of the wind penetrating through the divisions of the shutters, and she stepped boldly forward, carelessly humming a tune, to assure herself of its being so, peeped courageously behind each curtain, saw nothing on either low window seat to scare her, and on placing a hand against the shutter, felt the strongest conviction of the wind's force. She began, with a most happy indifference, to prepare herself for bed. She would not make up her fire, that would seem cowardly, as if she wished for the protection of light after she were in bed. The fire, therefore, died away. And Catherine, having spent the best part of an hour in her arrangements, was beginning to think of stepping into bed when, on giving a parting glance round the room, she was struck by the appearance of a high, old-fashioned black cabinet, which, though in a situation conspicuous enough, had never caught her notice before. Henry's words, his description of the ebony cabinet, which was to escape her observation at first, immediately rushed across her. It was certainly a very remarkable coincidence. She took her candle and looked closely at the cabinet. It was not absolutely ebony and gold, but it was Japan, black and yellow Japan of the handsomest kind. The key was in the door, and she had a strange fancy to look into it. Not, however, with the smallest expectation of finding anything, but it was so very odd after what Henry had said. In short, she could not sleep till she had examined it. So, placing the candle with great caution on a chair, she seized the key with a very tremulous hand and tried to turn it, but it resisted her utmost strength. Alarmed, but not discouraged, she tried it another way. A bolt flew, and she believed herself successful. But how strangely mysterious! The door was still immovable. She paused a moment in breathless wonder, then again applied herself to the key, and after moving it in every possible way, the door suddenly yielded to her hand. Her heart leapt with exultation at such a victory, and having thrown open the other folding door also, a double range of small drawers appeared in view, with some larger drawers above and below them. In the centre, a small door, closed also with a lock and key, secured, in all probability, a cavity of importance. With a cheek flushed by hope and an eye straining with curiosity, Catherine's fingers grasped the handle of a drawer and drew it forth. It was entirely empty. With less alarm and greater eagerness, she seized a second, a third, a fourth. Each was equally empty. Well read in the art of concealing a treasure, the possibility of false linings to the drawers did not escape her, and she felt round each with anxious acuteness in vain. The place in the middle alone remained now unexplored. It would be foolish not to examine it thoroughly while she was about it. It was some time before she could unfasten the door, but at length it did open. Her quick eyes directly fell on a roll of paper pushed back into the furthest part of the cavity, apparently for concealment, and her feelings at that moment were indescribable. Her heart fluttered, her knees trembled, and her cheeks grew pale. She seized, with an unsteady hand, the precious manuscript. For half a glance sufficed to ascertain written characters. Despite her fears, she resolved instantly to peruse every line before she attempted to rest. The dimness of the light her candle emitted made her turn to it with alarm. Alas! A breeze snuffed it out! Catherine, for a few moments, was motionless with horror. Darkness, impenetrable and immovable, filled the room. A violent gust of wind, rising with sudden fury, added fresh horror to the moment. Catherine trembled from head to foot. In the pause which succeeded, a sound like receding footsteps and the closing of a distant door struck on her affrighted ear. Human nature could support no more. A cold sweat stood on her forehead. The manuscript fell from her hand, and groping her way to the bed, she jumped hastily in and sought some suspension of agony by creeping far underneath the clothes. To close her eyes in sleep that night, she felt, must be entirely out of the question, and the storm abroad was so dreadful. She had not been used to feel alarm from wind, but now every blast seemed fraught with awful intelligence. The manuscript, so wonderfully found, so wonderfully accomplishing the morning's prediction, how was it to be accounted for? What could it contain? To whom could it relate? By what means could it have been so long concealed? And how singularly strange that it should fall to her lot to discover it! Till she had made herself mistress of its contents, however, she could have neither response nor comfort. and with the sun's first rays, she was determined to peruse it. But many were the tedious hours which must yet intervene. She shuddered, tossed about in her bed, and envied every quiet sleeper. The very curtains of her bed seemed at one moment in motion, and at another the lock of her door was agitated, as if by the attempt of somebody to enter. Hollow murmurs seemed to creep along the gallery, and more than once her blood was chilled by the sound of distant moans. Hour after hour passed away, and the wearied Catherine had heard three proclaimed by all the clocks in the house before the tempest subsided, or she unknowingly fell fast asleep.
Good morning, Miss Morland.
Good morning.
Your fire is lit, and I have placed your papers on your table.
Papers? Oh, yes.
Will you be wanting me to dress you, Miss Morland?
No, thank you.
Very well. Breakfast shall be served directly.
In the very moment of the maid's going away, Catherine eagerly collected every sheet of the manuscript which had burst from the roll and flew back to enjoy the luxury of their perusal on her pillow. It was not a sizable manuscript, however. For the roll, seeming to consist entirely of small, disjointed sheets, was of trifling size and much less than she had supposed it to be at first. Her greedy eye glanced rapidly over a page. She started at its import. Could it be possible?
7 shirts, 8 pairs of stockings, 3 cravats and 4 waistcoats, a washing bill, hair powder, shoestring and breeches ball, to poultice... chestnut mare, nothing but bills.
Such was the collection of papers, left perhaps, as she could then suppose, by the negligence of a servant in the place whence she had taken them, which had filled her with expectation and alarm and robbed her of half her night's rest. She felt humbled to the dust. Could not the adventure of the chest have taught her wisdom? Nothing could now be clearer than the absurdity of her recent fancies. To suppose that a manuscript of many generations back could have remained undiscovered in a room such as that, so modern, so habitable, or that she should be the first to possess the skill of unlocking a cabinet, the key of which was open to all. How could she have so imposed on herself? Heaven forbid that Henry Tilney should ever know her folly. And it was in a great measure his own doing. For had not the cabinet appeared so exactly to agree with his description of her adventures, she should never have felt the smallest curiosity about it. This was the only comfort that occurred. She got away as soon as she could from a room in which her conduct produced such unpleasant reflections, and found her way with all speed to the breakfast parlour, where she was greeted warmly by Henry.
I do hope you were not disturbed by the tempest.
The wind kept me awake a little. But we have a charming morning after it, and storms and sleeplessness are nothing when they are over. What beautiful hyacinths! I have just learnt to love a hyacinth.
And how might you learn? By accident or argument?
Your sister taught me. I cannot tell how Mrs. Allen used to take pains year after year to make me like them. But I never could, till I saw them the other day in Milsom Street. I'm naturally indifferent about flowers.
But now you love a hyacinth. So much the better. You have gained a new source of enjoyment, and it is well to have as many holds upon happiness as possible. Besides, a taste for flowers is always desirable in your sex as a means of getting you out of doors and tempting you to more frequent exercise than you would otherwise take. And though the love of a hyacinth may be rather domestic, who can tell? The sentiment once raised, but you may in time come to love a rose.
But I do not want any such pursuit to get me out of doors. The pleasure of walking and breathing fresh air is enough for me. And in fine weather, I am out more than half my time. Mama says I am never within.
At any rate, however, I am pleased that you have learned to love a hyacinth. The mere habit of learning to love is the thing. And the teachableness of disposition in a young lady is a great blessing. Has my sister a pleasant mode of instruction?
Good morning, Miss Morland.
Good morning, General Tilney.
I'm glad you have found Henry as your breakfast companion. I'm a little late in rising, in sympathy with our guest.
The breakfast set is very elegant.
Oh, I am glad you approve. It was my choice. It is neat and simple, but I think it right to encourage the manufacture of my own country. For my part, to my uncritical palate, the tea was as well flavoured from the clay of Staffordshire as from that of Dresden or Sèvres. But this is quite an old set. I purchased it 2 years ago. The manufacture has much improved since that time. I have seen some beautiful specimens when last in town, and had I not been perfectly without vanity of that kind, I might have been tempted to order a new set. I trust, however, that an opportunity might ere long occur of selecting one, though not for myself.
Catherine was probably the only one of the party who did not understand him. Shortly after breakfast, Henry left them for Woodston, where business required and would keep him 2 or 3 days. They all attended in the hall to see him mount his horse, and immediately on re-entering the breakfast room, Catherine walked to a window in the hope of catching another glimpse of his figure.
This is a somewhat heavy call upon your brother's fortitude, Eleanor. Woodston will make but a sombre appearance today.
Is it a pretty place?
What say you, Eleanor? Speak your opinion, for ladies can best tell the taste of ladies in regard to places as well as men. I think it would be acknowledged by the most impartial eye to have many recommendations. The house stands among fine meadows facing the southeast, with an excellent kitchen garden in the same aspect, the walls surrounding which I built and stocked myself about 10 years ago for the benefit of my son. It is a family living, Miss Morland, and the property in the place being chiefly my own, you may believe I take care that it shall not be a bad one. Did Henry's income depend solely on this living, he would not be ill provided for. Perhaps it may seem odd that with only 2 younger children I should think any profession necessary for him, and certainly there are moments when we could all wish him disengaged from every tie of business. But though I may not exactly make converts of you young ladies, I am sure your father, Miss Morland, would agree with me in thinking it expedient to give every young man some employment. The money is nothing. It is not an object. But employment is the thing. Even Frederick, my eldest son, you see, who will perhaps inherit as considerable a landed property as any private man in the county, has his profession.
I am sure my father would agree with you, General.
Well, Eleanor, it is time for your friend to see Northanger in full, is it not? May I show you over the house?
Thank you. I should be delighted.
And when we have gone over the house, I should like the pleasure of accompanying you into the shrubberies and garden. But perhaps it might be more agreeable to you to make those your first object. The weather is at present favourable, and at this time of year it is greatly uncertain that it shall continue so. Which would you prefer? I am equally at your service. Eleanor, which do you think would most accord with your fair friend's wishes? But I think I can discern. Yes, I certainly read in Miss Morland's eyes a judicious desire of making use of the present smiling weather. But when did she judge amiss? The abbey would always be safe and dry. I shall fetch my hat and attend you in a moment.
Miss Tilney, I do not wish your father to be taking us out of doors against his own inclination, under a mistaken idea of pleasing me.
I believe it will be wisest to take the morning while it is so fine. And do not be uneasy on my father's account. He always walks out at this time of day.
Catherine did not exactly know how this was to be understood. Why was Miss Tilney embarrassed? Could there be any unwillingness on the General's side to show her over the abbey? The proposal was his own. It was certainly very provoking. She was all impatience to see the house and had scarcely any curiosity about the grounds. If Henry had been with them, indeed. But now she should not know what was picturesque when she saw it. Such were her thoughts, but she kept them to herself and put on her bonnet in patient discontent. She was struck, however, beyond her expectation, by the grandeur of the abbey as she saw it for the first time from the lawn. The whole building enclosed a large court, and 2 sides of the quadrangle, rich in Gothic ornaments, stood forward for admiration. The remainder was shut off by knolls of old trees or luxuriant plantations. Catherine had seen nothing to compare with it, and her feelings of delight were so strong that, without waiting for any better authority, she boldly burst forth in wonder and praise. The General listened with assenting gratitude, and it seemed as if his own estimation of Northanger had waited unfixed till that hour. The kitchen garden was to be next admired, and he led the way to it across a small portion of the park. The number of acres contained in this garden was such as Catherine could not listen to without dismay, being more than double the extent of all Mr. Allen's as well as her father's, including churchyard and orchard. The walls seemed countless in number, endless in length. A village of hothouses seemed to arise among them, and a whole parish to be at work within the enclosure.
What think you, Miss Morland?
I have never seen gardens like them before.
I do not own any ambition about them myself, but I do believe them to be unrivaled in the kingdom. If I have a hobby horse, it is this. I do love a garden. Though I am careless enough in most matters of eating, I love good fruit. Or if I do not, my friends and children do. Come, let me show you the succession house. I must say, however, there are great vexations attending such a garden as mine. The utmost care cannot always secure the most valuable fruits. The pinery yielded only 100 in the last year. Mr. Allen, I suppose, must feel these inconveniences as well as myself.
No, not at all. Mr. Allen does not care about the garden, and he never goes into it.
I wish I could do the same. For I never entered mine without being vexed in some way or other by its falling short of my plan. How are Mr. Allen's succession houses worked?
Oh, Mr. Allen only has one small hothouse, which Mrs. Allen has the use of for her plants in winter, and there is a fire in it now and then.
He is a happy man. There is a particular fruiting tree in its infancy down here.
But, Papa, this door here leads back into the garden. Perhaps we may take it.
Yes, perhaps we shall. I wish to see some recent alterations to the tea house. It may not be an unpleasant extension of our walk if Miss Morland were not tired.
Not at all.
I'm sure you shall like the tea house, Miss Morland.
Eleanor, why do you choose the fir grove to walk through? Miss Morland will get wet. Our best way is across the park.
The fir grove is so favourite a walk of mine that I always think it the best and nearest way. But perhaps it may be damp.
I should be eager to walk that way if it is your favourite.
'Tis too gloomy for me. I shall meet you by another course.
It is such a delightfully melancholy walk.
I am particularly fond of this spot. It was my mother's favourite walk. I used to walk here so often with her, though I never loved it then as I've loved it since. At that time, indeed, I used to wander at her choice. But her memory endears it now.
And ought it not to endear it to her husband? Yet the general would not enter it.
No.
Her death must have been a great affliction.
A great and increasing one. I was only 13 when it happened. And though I felt my loss perhaps as strongly as one so young could feel it, I did not, I could not, then know what a loss it was. I have no sister, you know, and though both my brothers are very affectionate, and Henry is a great deal here, which I am most thankful for, it is impossible for me not to often be solitary. A mother would have been always present. A mother would have been a constant friend. Her influence would have been beyond all other.
Was she a very charming woman?
Very. She had such a pleasant countenance and agreeable nature. I do not know of anyone who did not find her charming.
Was she handsome?
I believe so. Her features were very fine.
Is there any picture of her in the abbey?
Yes, and I'm so glad of it. Memory might otherwise have faded her image.
Why had she been so partial to this grove? And was it from dejection of spirits? Her picture, I suppose, hangs in your father's room.
No, it was intended for the drawing room, but my father was dissatisfied with the painting, and for some time it had no place. Soon after her death, I obtained it for my own and hung it in my bedchamber. I shall be happy to show it to you. It is very like.
Catherine's interest in the deceased Mrs. Tilney augmented with every question. Of her unhappiness in marriage, she felt persuaded. The general certainly had been an unkind husband. He did not love her walk. Could he therefore have loved her? And besides, handsome as he was, there was a something in the turn of his features which spoke his not having behaved well to her. The picture was another proof. A portrait, very like of a departed wife, not valued by the husband. He must have been dreadfully cruel to her. Catherine attempted no longer to hide from herself the nature of the feelings which, in spite of all his attentions, he had previously excited. And what had been terror and dislike before was now absolute aversion. Yes, aversion. His cruelty to such a charming woman made him odious to her. She had often read of such characters, characters which Mr. Allen had been used to call unnatural and overdrawn, but here was proof positive of the contrary. She had just settled this point when the end of the path brought them directly upon the General.
There, we are well met. The weather has certainly favoured your visit, Miss Morland, but you look a little pale. Are you quite well?
Yes, quite well. Thank you.
I think it's time you return to the house and sit by a fire. I shall join you in a quarter of an hour. Eleanor, take good care of Miss Morland, but do not show her the rest of the Abbey until I return.
Are you feeling well now, Miss Morland?
Yes, perfectly. Thank you.
I'm glad of it. I cannot tell you how delightful it is to have you here.
I can think of nowhere I should rather be. I am sorry that Henry is often away at Woodston, however.
My father does insist on him being employed. It is favourable, however, that he is at liberty to develop a home entirely his own.
Here you are. Forgive me, I was detained with business.
Might we show Miss Morland the house now? She is most eager to see it. I think her taste in the Gothic is unsurpassed.
But of course, let us not delay a moment longer. We shall start in the real drawing room.
Are we not in the drawing room already?
This is the common drawing room. The real drawing room is exceedingly grand by comparison.
This is the drawing room.
Oh!
Your discerning eye lights upon every detail, Miss Morland. The colour of the satin, the intricate furniture.
I know little of such things, I am afraid.
Nonsense! It is not beyond your experience to discern the quality of such a room. The paper on the walls, I am sure you have spied, is silk.
It is very noble, very grand, very charming.
They soon set forward, and with a grandeur of air, a dignified step which caught the eye but could not shake the doubts of the well-read Catherine, General Tilney led the way. They proceeded into the library, an apartment in its way of equal magnificence. Catherine heard, admired, and wondered with more genuine feeling than before. They continued to proceed, but suites of apartments did not spring up with her wishes. Large as was the building, she had already visited the greatest part. It was some relief that they were to return to the rooms in common use by passing through a few of less importance, looking into the court, which, with occasional passages, not wholly unintricate, connected the different sides. She was further soothed in her progress by being told that she was treading what had once been a cloister, having traces of cells pointed out, and observing several doors that were neither opened nor explained to her. By finding herself successively in a billiard room and in the general's private apartment without comprehending their connection or being able to turn aright when she left them, and lastly, by passing through a dark little room, owning Henry's authority and strewed with his litter of books, guns and greatcoats. In the dining room, of which, though already seen and always to be seen at 5 o'clock, the General could not forego the pleasure of pacing out the length for the more certain information of Miss Morland as to what she neither doubted nor cared for. They proceeded to the kitchen, the ancient kitchen of the convent, rich in the massy walls and smoke of former days, and in the stoves and hot closets of the present. The General's improving hand had not loitered here. Every modern invention to facilitate the labour of the cooks had been adopted within this their spacious theatre. With the walls of the kitchen ended all the antiquity of the Abbey, the fourth side of the quadrangle having, on account of its decaying state, been removed by the General's father and the present erected in its place. All that was venerable ceased here. The new building was not only new, but declared itself to be so, intended only for offices, and enclosed behind by stable yards. No uniformity of architecture had been thought necessary. Catherine could have raved at the hand which had swept away what must have been beyond the value of all the rest, for the purposes of mere domestic economy, and would willingly have been spared the mortification of a walk through scenes so fallen. They took a slight survey of all, and Catherine was impressed beyond her expectation by their multiplicity and their convenience. The purposes, for which a few shapeless pantries and a comfortless scullery were deemed sufficient at Fullerton, were here carried on in appropriate divisions, commodious and roomy. The number of servants continually appearing did not strike her less than the number of their offices. Wherever they went, some patterned girl stopped to curtsy, or some footman in dishabille sneaked off. They returned to the hall, that the chief staircase might be ascended, and the beauty of its wood and ornaments of rich carving might be pointed out. Having gained the top, they turned in an opposite direction from the gallery in which her room lay, and shortly entered one on the same plan but superior in length and breadth. She was here shown successively into three large bedchambers with their dressing rooms most completely and handsomely fitted up. Everything that money and taste could do to give comfort and elegance to apartments had been bestowed on these, and being furnished within the last 5 years, they were perfect in all that would be generally pleasing, and wanting in all that could give pleasure to Catherine. She cared for no furniture of a more modern date than the 15th century.
I hope that henceforward, Miss Morland, some of our earliest tenants in these bedchambers might be our friends from Fullerton.
That is most kind of you, sir.
Eleanor, where are you going? Has not Miss Morland already seen all that could be worth her notice? And do you not suppose your friend might be glad of some refreshment after so much exercise?
Yes, of course.
I shall order tea. Please return to the drawing room. I shall meet you there directly.
Catherine, having seen in a momentary glance a narrower passage, more numerous openings, and symptoms of a winding staircase, believed herself at last within the reach of something worth her notice. The General's evident desire of preventing such an examination was an additional stimulant.
I was going to take you into what was my mother's room, the room in which she died.
It remains as it was, I suppose.
Yes, entirely.
And how long ago may it be that your mother died?
She has been dead these 9 years.
You were with her, I suppose, to the last?
No, I was unfortunately from home. Her illness was sudden and short, and before I arrived it was all over.
Catherine's blood ran cold with the horrid suggestions which naturally sprang from these words. Could it be possible? Could Henry's father... And yet, how many were the examples to justify even the blackest suspicions? The General's preventing her examination of his late wife's room was an additional stimulant. Something was certainly to be concealed. Her fancy, though it had trespassed lately once or twice, could not mislead her here. And when she saw him in the evening while she worked with her friend, slowly pacing the drawing room for an hour together in silent thoughtfulness, with downcast eyes and contracted brow, she felt secure from all possibility of wronging him. It was the air and attitude of a Montoni. What could more plainly speak the gloomy workings of a mind not wholly dead to every sense of humanity in its fearful review of past scenes of guilt? Unhappy man! Such ill-timed exercise was of a piece with the strange unseasonableness of his morning walks and boded nothing good. After such an evening, Catherine was heartily glad to be dismissed by him.
I hope, Miss Morland, that we have not given you too much exercise today.
By no means. I'm used to much more at Fullerton.
Are you indeed? The country air must agree with you. I hope you rest well. I'm afraid I have many pamphlets to finish before I can close my eyes, and perhaps may be poring over the affairs of the nation for hours after you are asleep. Can either of us be more meekly employed? My eyes will be blinding for the good of others, and yours preparing by rest for future mischief.
But neither the business alleged nor the magnificent compliment could win Catherine from thinking that some very different object must occasion so serious a delay of proper repose. To be kept up for hours after the family were in bed by stupid pamphlets was not very likely. There must be some deeper cause. Something was to be done which could be done only while the household slept, and the probability that Mrs. Tilney yet lived, shut up for causes unknown and receiving from the pitiless hands of her husband a nightly supply of coarse food, was the conclusion which necessarily followed. Shocking, as was the idea, it was at least better than a death unfairly hastened, as in the natural course of things she must ere long be released. The suddenness of her reputed illness, the absence of her daughter and probably of her other children at the time, all favoured the supposition of her imprisonment. Its origin, jealousy, perhaps, or wanton cruelty, was yet to be unravelled. In revolving these matters while she undressed, it suddenly struck her as not unlikely that she might that morning have passed near the very spot of this unfortunate woman's confinement, might have been within a few paces of the cell in which she languished out her days. For what part of the abbey could be more fitted for the purpose than that which yet bore the traces of monastic division? In the high-arched passage, paved with stone, which already she had trodden with peculiar awe, she well remembered the doors of which the general had given no account. To what might not those doors lead? In support of the plausibility of this conjecture, it further occurred to her that the forbidden gallery in which lay the apartments of the unfortunate Mrs. Tilney must be, as certainly as her memory could guide her, exactly over this suspected range of cells, and the staircase by the side of those apartments of which she had caught a transient glimpse, communicating by some secret means with those cells, might well have favoured the barbarous proceedings of her husband. Down that staircase she had perhaps been conveyed in a state of well-prepared insensibility. Catherine sometimes started at the boldness of her surmises, and sometimes hoped or feared that she had gone too far, but they were supported by such appearances as made their dismissal impossible. The side of the quadrangle in which she supposed the guilty seemed to be acting, being, according to her belief, just opposite her own, it struck her that if, judiciously watched, some rays of light from the general's lamp might glimmer through the lower windows as he passed to the prison of his wife. And twice before she stepped into bed, she stole gently from her room to the corresponding window in the gallery to see if it appeared. But all abroad was dark, and it must yet be too early. The various ascending noises convinced her that the servants,